Welcome to the GRF On The Go podcast. The subject matter experts at GRF CPAs and Advisors created this podcast to offer insights on current topics, as well as new ideas and best practices that your team can apply today. This podcast was originally presented as a live webinar. CPE information provided during the podcast is no longer valid, but if you're interested in watching the video version of this session or accessing the slide deck, visit our website at grfcpa.com/events. Enjoy the episode and remember to subscribe for future content.
Hello, I want to welcome everyone participating in today's webinar, Unlimited PTO, Federally Funded Contractors and Nonprofit Grant Recipients Subject to FAR and Uniform Guidance. My name is Yevgeny Sahenko. I'm a partner in the Outsourced Accounting and Advisory Services Department here at GRF. We call it OAAS for short. Today, we're joined by my colleague, Paul Calabrese, principal in our OAAS department. Paul has a wealth of experience and knowledge in working with federal contractors and federal grant recipients. Please also note that this webinar is not intended as financial or legal advice. This is simply for educational purposes. So with that, we're GRF CPAs and Advisors. We're based out of Bethesda, Maryland, serving clients primarily in the DMV area, but also nationally and internationally. Our firm serves a wide range of clients covering nonprofit, for-profit, schools, government contractors, and others. However, our particular niche is within the non-for-profit space and INGO space. We've been in operation for several decades, and in 2021, we actually celebrated our 40-year anniversary. As you can see here, we have a lot of exciting content to cover. So without further ado, let's jump into it. All yours, Paul.
Thank you, Yev. Appreciate it. Well, welcome, everybody. And like Yev said, you know, I am a subject matter expert in the GovCon arena. And so anything with DCAA, if you ever heard of them, policy, procedures, rates, I can help you with it. So our agenda today, let's just go back a little bit, it's okay, is going to be, we're going to define unlimited PTO, that is paid absence. And we'll talk about the employers that have it or don't have it. And when we talk about paid time off, we're talking about vacation and annual leave and sick leave all being wrapped into that. Everybody has a little bit different policy when it comes to paid absence. We'll talk again about the employers that have it, those and how they use it. We are relying on some surveys that are very helpful, and you'll see notes. And I believe on slide 51, we in the presentation as well as the notes handout show our references to those surveys, which are very, very helpful. And then just really the potential pitfalls. You know, you're dealing with two major areas. This is a government contractor webinar, but also we'll touch on some of the uniform guidance and really how they would respond or how they would direct us in terms of paid absences and what we should do. Because when you have federal funding, everybody knows there's much, much more compliance requirements. But even if you've joined today and your organization doesn't have even federal funding, you still may be curious, and we will go through enough to give you a sense of what is unlimited paid time off and some of the state government restrictions that are on their concerns and just employees' concerns and employees' interest in this new emerging benefit. And we'll talk about a work plan and some internal analysis and our final thoughts. If you have questions, you know, you can raise it during our webinar as well. So one of the things that you need to understand before you start is that whenever you're dealing with grants or contracts, it's both legal, it's both administrative, regulatory, and accounting. But in this case, we're going to get into some of the HR issues. And so I'm just telling you, I'm not an HR expert, I'm not a legal expert. And that's why we've relied on some of these other surveys done by experts in the field to give us a better understanding of the environment. So what we're going to do is we look at the PTO and we're saying that's a significant amount of compensation. that people get. And it's just something you cannot ignore. And it's an important benefit. And so what we're going to talk about in the HR area is that HR is mostly interested in two things, the benefits and the recruiting side. And it is not uncommon all the times you are interested as an entity in bringing in new personnel, you're going to want to reach out to those who just got out of college. And that's what we call, I guess, Gen Z. Those between 21 and 27, 28, that's the environment that Unlimited PTO was really oriented to. They hear a lot on social media, and it's something that's new that interests them, the concept that basically you can take as much off as you want, so long as you work that out with your manager. So that's something that has piqued their interest, and a lot of companies, especially the software, hardware entities, media, they've been wanting to attract those people. And if you're not familiar, just in most of the major professions, there are difficulties in attracting new personnel for their companies. And of course, there will be gap impacts too. You know, as we know that right now, paid absence is a gap, is a liability type of issue. So those are some of the things that we got to address and deal with as we go down this road here. So let's talk about it. Is it really a cultural shift to unlimited PTO? So let's define it first. Employees can take off as much time as they desire from management's perspective, so long as they get the job done. So there's a relationship of trust. In many of these organizations, the purpose is to almost eliminate time tracking or the administrative burden. So that's an issue that we have to address for contract and grant compliance and how that would all work, if at all. You know, firms are competing for the best talent. We talked about it in the Gen Z interest. Interestingly, at this point in time, as of 2023, only 6% of employers that they've surveyed really offer unlimited PTO. So it is something new and different. As we get into some of this, you know, the employer or the employee, you know, must obtain prior management approval before using unlimited PTO because they're like a team. Many people in the software world, they're working on various tasks. They probably have some kind of very fancy PERT or Gantt chart, and they're performing and trying to get certain tasks for the software to do certain things. So they must work as a team, and you've got to see that. That may be very true in some of the dynamic things that are happening in government contracting. And if they're working as such a close-knit team, you know, taking off time when they have to get a project done may be a challenge. It's still paid like annual leave, but there's no accrued benefit. So all of a sudden, things start to change. It's just like holiday, and if you still had sick leave, or you had jury duty, or those types of things, bereavement, it's taken and it's recorded as used. Until it's used, it's not recorded or expensed. Accrued PTO, obviously, is it recorded on an accrual basis, on an earning basis, either by pay period or something else. I don't know what that is. Okay. So in the past, we know that PTO been accrued. It's a liability. We know there's usually a yearly cap. It can vary. We can just use the example. An entity may have up to 160 hours that it gives its employees that before that will roll over to the next period, but you can't get beyond it or you lose that benefit. Upon termination, you get that unused paid time off. So those are some of the things that we know and how it works. Since PTO is not accrued, there is, of course, no payout employee termination. What I threw in here is something in note 3, and that is the Pew Foundation. The Pew Foundation, you know, they get into all these surveys. And what's the relationship typically across the nation? And really, believe it or not, only 20% of the workforce, which is pretty low, really, has a very fair or poor opinion of their boss. 16% regard work-life balance, a poor work-life balance. So it seems in reality, from what I can see from some of these surveys, is the higher level positions are people that are have good relationships with the boss. The boss may be a team member. Often, especially in public accounting, we've seen they're working just as hard as the workabees, so to speak. And so there's a good relationship. But if there's a bad relationship between the employee and the boss, then there are issues because you're going to be asking them with, you do have a benefit of unlimited PTO, but you have no balance. You have nothing to draw from. It is simply a relationship with your boss to say, you know, I'm ready to take off leave. And, you know, you've got to get approval. But what you're going to find in a minute as we go through some of these surveys is there are some difficulties. According to Roku's policy, I think they're, I know they produce servers and things like that. You must still get your job done on time and not impact your team's work. Again, notice teamwork. You're doing something as a group. So yeah, they don't mind when you take stuff off, but if you're always working on something, when will you get that opportunity? When will management come to a place where there's not a project that has a due date? When will that ever happen? Especially if you're working as a team. According to Twitter employees stated on Glassdoor, you know, they were unable to use most of their benefit because of the workload. One company was literally forced a paid week off because of exhaustion and some of these notes. So that begins to tell you a little bit about the lifestyle here. So what we're going to do is in the next three or four slides, let's go through this. It's a little slow. Okay. I didn't realize this would go that slow, but that's okay. Okay. So on the left side, these are some of the things we were able to pull out from the survey. You're going to see in the next three columns to the right, the firm, the entity, and where they check off the box. If you notice here, no time tracking and must receive prior approval. So there's no time tracking of work or vacation hours and must receive pre-approval before getting employees manager. All of these entities have that requirement. So they've dropped timekeeping. And those of us in the accounting world, or if you're a government contractor or a recipient of grant funds, you know you've got to do time tracking. And it's the thing that we do not enjoy. And these entities have eliminated, they're using some other performance-oriented metrics to evaluate the performance of their employees. And time is not considered part of that. They also, of course, all universally must get management approval. So let's go through some of this and see how it comes out. And this is going to be interesting. We are having a little problem here. I didn't think that this would be a problem, but let's see. Maybe Nathan can help me. So what I'm going to do, because those were slides that went through each one, I'm going to tell you Netflix. They said you could set your own holiday and vacation schedule. All of them, again, had no time tracking of vacation or work hours. And pre-approval beforehand for employees manager. They call it work-life philosophy. Oracle, the only thing they talked about was no time tracking and getting prior approval. They call it flexible vacation. LinkedIn had the same, except at the end of the year, they had a week-long paid leave for all employees. They were also had to force their employees to take a week off due to overexhaustion. So there, that's not a good situation. Zoom, pretty much the same as others, just as far as vacation hours and no tracking of time. And also, you know, the pre-approval. Evernote, the one thing that was different, Evernote actually gave them an incentive. They said, take leave of 5 days or more and receive 1,000 annual vacation stipends. So you're beginning to see through just a limited survey of employers in the cutting edge software world, where they're using cutting edge or different benefits to attract employees, that there's some issues here. And Salesforce, similar to all the others, nothing unique there. When we go to Asana, the same. Roku said you could also set your holiday and vacation schedule. And they were the ones, as I said before, as long as you get your work done and don't impact your team's work, you can take as much as you want. HubSpot is a marketing or program, and a mandatory week off in July at a five-year mark, you can get a four-week sabbatical. And the last of the three, let's just see if there's anything interesting there. Chegg said employees were reluctant to use unlimited PTO, and they also forced leave due to employee exhaustion. No difference with Adobe, and Twitter had a similar thing where employees struggled to use it due to a heavy workload. So there we go. We got through that. Let's see how this works. Apparently, this is also giving me a problem, so that's okay. So basically, when I compare the company features and the downside, LinkedIn and Chegg had forced PTO. Roku must get work done on time and not impact the team's work. Twitter struggle to find time to use unlimited PTO. And Chegg, employees were reluctant to use unlimited PTO. So you can see that there is some issues there. Now it's going back to this. So we'll go through it. And you can see real quickly the benefits. Apologize. Perhaps in the future, I should just not put in all these animations. But you get a sense of what each one of these organizations are doing. And you will get a copy of the notes and the PowerPoint as well, so you can get a sense of it. But you can see here that employees are having a real hard time getting to use this wonderful benefit of unlimited PTO. And I believe it's an important thing to stress, especially if you're considering doing something like this. And finally, we get into this. We'll see how this works. And here again, you can see LinkedIn, Chegg, Force PTO, Roku, must get work done. You know, as long as you can get the team works done, you can take as much as you want. Struggle to find time to use PTO. And finally, Chegg, employees were reluctant to use unlimited PTO. So that, in a nutshell, sets the framework, the background, for what we're going to talk about as far as the regulations go. This gives us a background of the industry and what's going on at this point with it. So let's go into unlimited PTO. This is a very good analysis that was done by a legal team, and it's in the footnotes on slide 51. And basically, certain states are already seeing this trend towards unlimited PTO, and they are concerned that people will not take advantage of employees. So here's some of the things from the state of Massachusetts. This is one of the states that got involved. Many of you may not have clients, entities in Massachusetts, but Massachusetts, I think Colorado, California, there are states that are concerned about this new benefit, and they have recommendations to stay away from forcing an employee to give up accrued PTO prematurely if you're going to transition from accrued PTO to unlimited PTO. And so employees should not be forced, of course, to give up unused PTO. Some states will permit the employer to basically establish a deadline to say at a certain point, we're going to give you plenty of advance notice. We'll go through this example towards the end. But at that certain point, basically, you know, you're going to have to give it up. Employers must inform employees of the change of policy so they can use their PTO. And during the transition period, if the employee terminates, they get their unused leave. There are different, it depends. There's no mandatory requirements, although certain states have, like here, certain requirements. And that's why this legal firm on benefits is saying this is a good employer practice. And finally, you should be tracking the accrued PTO until the point it's either use or lose or along those lines. Okay, so some of you, I'm sure, are very aware and are savvy to the fact that you saw in the very beginning, one of the so-called benefits is that you don't have to track, you don't have to track your time and attendance. And of course, we understand that with federal money, that's a mandatory requirement, something we just cannot get around. The problem is that when you go into the FAR talks about it in terms of allocation. They don't exactly talk about time reporting. They just talk about allocations. So I want to give you a quick building blocks for government contractors. The FAR is the Federal Acquisition Regulation, and the cost principles FAR subpart 31.2 is where it starts. And it's basically talking about a cost recovery formula. And in the middle, it talks about the sum of direct and indirect costs allocable to a contract. And that's what we want to focus on. We want to focus on how do we put costs on a contract? And we know if it's direct, we're identifying it through a timesheet or through some mechanism. But you notice as I go through these slides, you know, what's missing here? They're not directly talking about time reporting, but yet the concept is there. So it's something to think about and be aware of. So in this argument here, or this statement, what it's basically saying is that allocable costs must be allowable to have a, excuse me, to go back. If you want to be allowable, you know, and you're going to allocate and you're going to do it based on reasonableness, but in that allocation, you have to include allowable costs. And we know in the FAR, there are cost principles, 51 or 52 of them. And so those cost principles are going to take each situation with relating to compensation, saying it's allowable, it's unallowable. Like for some reason, stock, if you give people benefit in terms of stock, it's an unallowable cost because their market changes. Its valuation is always going to change. And the government just says, if you give them a benefit as a stock option, it's unallowable, as an example. So the key here is that allocability is just simply assigning a cost direct or indirect through the burden structure. Now I'm going to turn it over to Jeff.
Perfect. Thanks, Paul. Okay, so we are on our first polling question. And the question is a true or false question, which reads, the Federal Acquisition Regulation subpart 31.2 specifically mentions timesheets as required to properly allocate labor charges. And again, the answer choices are either true, false, or unsure. Okay, so it looks like, Paul, we're about fairly evenly split, a little bit more toward false with 45%, but true came in at 39% and about 15% were unsure.
All right. Well, the answer is it's not true. It's false. And that's the point of what I'm trying to make here is that for some reason, the FAR is not quite as specific. We'll also briefly touch on the uniform guidance because we want to talk about grants and cooperative agreements and how they're impacted by unlimited PTO. And so unfortunately, they're relying on industry, they're relying on audit, cognizant audit, and just people to understand. And so they take the high level, you know, they're just talking about allocation, but they don't quite get into, hey, you must have a timesheet, except in one area. So here, in terms of allowability, they're defining allowability, and they're again talking about this one little area, allocability. And so we understand that if something isn't allocated properly as a direct charge or an indirect charge, that it you cannot recover that cost. And in the world of government contracting and grants and cooperative agreements, that's a big deal. So, and it talks about what a cost is allocable. And when it says identified specifically to contract, it's talking about direct costs. or it can be something that's allocated between contracts, or it can be allocated as a direct cost and an indirect cost, like fringe benefits put in a service pool can be allocated both direct and indirect. And it's either necessary for the overall operation of an entity, and that would be totally indirect. So it's talking about these kinds of theories. If you follow these patterns specifically, you won't have a problem. But if you don't and don't have an ability to allocate, there would be real issues. So let's go further into it. So time tracking is a necessary part of a FAR-based system. Think of it this way. Unfortunately, I wish the FAR would be a little bit more specific. As you'll see right below, there's one area where they do talk a little bit about timekeeping in a checklist. But think of it this way. From the government standpoint, allocating labor, allocability, it equals labor charging. Labor charging equals time tracking, which equals the necessity for timesheets, which today by most entities is done through electronic software. So that's the way they do it. If A equals B, B equals C, C equals D, so therefore allocating and timekeeping, that's the way they logically present it, as well as most people who are in government contracting know it's an industry standard and requirement. But below there, FAR 53209-1, that's that checklist. Some people have had what DCA, Defense Contract Audit Agency, has done, called an SF-1408 Contractor Pre-Award Accounting System Survey. And in there, only one item says a timekeeping system, this is one of the requirements, that identifies employees' labor by intermediate and final cost objective. And that's just a fancy way of saying time can go to an intermediate thing like a service pool, an overhead, G&A, into a final cost objective would be the contract. But that's pretty much the only place we're going to see in the FAR itself. And below, you've seen timesheets. This is a manual one under a manual system with dates and employee and supervisor's signature and the direct charges, the indirect, and paid absence. But the question is, under the FAR, how would you value time? How would you value paid absence without a time reporting system? The hours have to be tracked somehow to a code to establish a value. And PTO is an expense. It's an indirect expense. And for the government contractor, it's either going to be in fringe, overhead, or G&A, depending upon the allocation methodology. And how are you going to value it? How is that going to impact your bottom line? So what we see is, yes, we as an entity did have a client who was a government contractor, and we helped them with unlimited PTO, but they still had to have time tracking. There was no way. We had to show the management just what we're showing you here. We went through all the steps and basically said, there's just no way you can work or survive without time tracking. So that's the end of that. Now, in this clause here, and it's dealing with reasonableness of compensation plans, if you're with DOD or civilian agencies, you must notify an ACO, that's an administrative contracting officer, different than the procuring agency. You must notify them in advance, or at least right after you've set in a new compensation plan. But basically what they're saying is there's no presumption of allowability. That can be a real problem. And that's something you don't want to invest in something like this without letting them know ahead of time. They want to be involved in, you know, as we've already determined, you know, paid absence is a significant amount of an employee's cost. So it's something that we can't just avoid. One last point I just want to make, moving off this slide. The ACO system is really big with Department of Defense. It's gigantic. Their budget, it's not in the trillions, but it's in many of the billions each year. And so an ACO in the FAR has about almost 70 different functions. In a lot of the civilian agencies, the ACO and the PCO is the buying activity. They may assign certain people to do more administrative than buying functions, but DOD is so large that they have their own ACOs, and you deal with their own auditors called Defense Contract Audit Agency, which I used to work for. And sometimes you'd have to negotiate and work things out with the ACO. So that's, I'm just trying to explain to you, it's a little bit different in this world. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but there is also, if you are a very large government contractor, you could also be covered by the cost accounting standards. And a lot of people that get into government contracting, they're very concerned about the CAS, the cost accounting standards. And they, you know, but you first have to be compliant in the FAR level before you get to the CAS. And you can see those are high, that 7.5 million is, that's a value. You'd have to have a negotiated cost type or fixed price subject to cost or pricing data. I know that's a lot of jargon, and if you're not into it, it sounds like gobbledygook. But if you have those two types of negotiated contracts or subcontracts, and then you look at the total value of an award, if it's over 7.5 million, you're at least starting to get into the CAS world. You need 2 million overlapping to keep you in the CAS world. And they either are under 50 million or over 50 million. And that will explain. There is a CAS standard if you are over 50 million, the 19 standards. It's CAS 408. And they talk about accounting for cost of compensated personal absence. So that's kind of important. And also this concept of cost accounting practice change. Well, I'm going to turn this over to Yev on the next polling question.
Perfect. Thanks, Paul. Okay, so polling question number two. Are any cost accounting standards incorporated in the FAR subpart 31.2 cost principles? In this case, we have a simple yes or no. So yes, no, or once again, unsure. So give a little bit of time for everybody to register their answers. Okay, and in this case, it's certainly more overwhelming for the yes response, Paul, with about 60% of the total responses. No got about 14%, and unsure came in second place with about 26%.
So the yes has got it. There are about 8 or 9 CAS standards, cost accounting standards, that are incorporated in the FAR. So some of you are really, really very smart people. That come, not that those who didn't are not smart, but they obviously understand how the FAR works and the CAS. So moving right along, one of the things is if you're a super duper large government contractor, that's usually the way it is, and you got CAS coverage. Remember, if you're a small business, you're not CAS covered. So if you got 8A, woman owned, or any of that, you're exempt from CAS. And basically what it's saying is, when would there be a cost accounting practice change? And why would you be concerned about that? Because if it does, you have to do a cost impact statement, and that's misery. And it says that if you have an initial adoption of a cost accounting practice, and some other reasons. And so in this situation, because it's not a change to a method, technique, allocate, measure, assign cost, it's only an initial adoption of a new benefit. It's our belief that transitioning, if you were a government contractor, to unlimited PTO is not a cost accounting practice change, as we believe, as we have interpreted through the CAS. So we wanted to cover that for those of you who are under CAS requirements, not to worry if you were to change. So what is it for the uniform guidance? Uniform guidance is for like nonprofits or other recipients of grants and cooperative agreements. And they have those agreements most likely in most situations are cost reimbursable. And the standards for documenting personal expense, you can see here, they again want you to accurately reflect the work performed based on records. What do you think those records are? They're going to be timekeeping of some kind, system of internal controls. Here, it's somebody wrote this regulation exactly the way you would have loved to seen the FAR written, But they really got into it. And they said the charges have to be accurate, liable, and get it, properly allocated. So it's very, very clear. There is a revision to the uniform guidance, and there's little or no impact to time reporting, except they move this to Section G, which has no impact to you guys. And instead of referring to non-federal entities, they refer to it as recipients, now in sub-recipients. It's effective October 1st. And working on a federal grant or a cooperative agreement does require a timesheet. And those who are in that know that. But then you ask the question, okay, Paul, is there anywhere where, like with the FAR, like the ASO had to be notified in advance that there's a change? Well, from year to year, if you have those NICRA rates and negotiated indirect cost rate agreements, a lot of times each agency will have its own template. And within the template, there are checklists. And often they're going to ask you, as with HHS's checklist for a NICRA, and they're going to say, treatment of paid absence and fringe benefit statements have not changed since the last indirect cost agreement. So you have to either check it, yes or no. You know, has the treatment of paid absence. So in a sense, the review of recipients of federal awards and their indirect rates being negotiated, the government wants to know, are you changing the methodology for treating paid absence? Yeah, we're not going to accrue it anymore. It's just an expense like holiday, sick, or bereavement. And then just to close the gap, usually nonprofits aren't subject to CAS. Some large universities are. There is a rare type. There's a company called MITRE. They're technically a nonprofit, but they really function like a government contractor, and a few unique ones in the nonprofit world. But they're just set up as a nonprofit, but they function like a government contractor, and they do have contracts subject to CAS. But in most situations, most nonprofits aren't, because I don't want people to walk out of here getting worried about all those CAS things. So now in the remaining time that we have, what I'd like to do is just briefly, if I can speak correctly, go over what would be a work plan that would help you in addressing these things. And I know we have some people out there that are in the consulting world. And so a lot of consultants have to deal with this because you're working with a client. And so hopefully this will help you give you a little bit of it. There's a lot of detail here and limited time. So what I'll try to do is do it. The first thing in a work plan, when we talk about entitlement, we're talking about the benefit. When the person who helped develop this work plan did it, when he's talking about legacy, he's talking about existing PTO paid time off benefits. And so what we're talking here are, what are the policies and procedures of the client? Or the entity that you're working for and your need to change. And then we're going to, because you're a government contractor, and that's where we're focused on, this would be the same for the uniform guidance, you know, except you'd be looking at different regulations. How is that in relationship to FAR, CAS, and even GAAP? What are those things? This is your control environment. The second part of this is the control environment of the United States government. They too, effectively through their regulations, and we'll talk about DCA in a minute, they have their own policies and procedures that they want you to follow. And of course, you've got to pay attention to it. So this is the control environment of the United States government. The reason for DOD, Defense Contract Audit Agency, has its own manual. Defense Contract Audit Agency, DCA, influences many, many other agencies. Sometimes people at DCAA who can't go higher, they move over to EPA, they move over to to Department of Energy, and especially USAID. So USAID, in many ways, in its thinking about government contracting, thinks and acts almost like DCAA. In many, many, except of course, they're dealing in the international world, and there's a lot of other requirements with travel, COLAs, working in third world nations. You know, there's just a lot of different requirements there, but they think often like DCA does. So DCA, the reason I mentioned them, they have tremendous influence on other agencies. Even the thing called ASHTO, with state DOT, Department of Transportation, ASHTO world, they rely on the FAR and they rely on DCA's contract audit manual. So they're they're a prolific agency that you cannot ignore. And you have to look at what does the government require. And then the next thing that we want to see in here is the most key thing. What is the prior government audits? What is your risk of audit? If you're not going to really be reviewed by the government, should you really even worry too much about this? So this is something to think about. For example, the risk of audit I see in the three different areas. One, you'll have a higher risk of audit if you have cost reimbursable, cost plus fixed fee contracts. If you have those versus just being fixed price, time and material, or commercial, the chances are you're not going to see a government auditor as much. But you have cost type, cost reimbursable, you have to do at the end of the year and incur cost submission. Many of you know this. The second thing that's going to get you into more higher risk of audit is, are you into DOD or probably USAID, or are you with a civilian agency? And sometimes the civilians is definitely they're going to do an incur cost audit, but they don't have as much resource for oversight as DOD has a lot. You would be surprised how many different kinds of audits can be done. I'm not going to go through that now, and I may not remember everyone, but I have an itsy bitsy GovCon, and they've gone through every kind of audit that's ever been invented. And for whatever reason, they've been audited. So they have a high risk of audit because they have a lot of cost type contracts. The last thing that gives you a high risk of audit is prime versus sub. If you're a subcontractor, even though you got a lot of stuff, even if it may be cost reimbursable, there's probably lesser chance of interface, probably with a government audit. They can do, DCA does what we call assist audits of a prime contractor subs. But what I'm trying to say is, one, if you're dealing with DOD, two, you've got cost type, and three, you're a prime, you are prime to be audited by a government entity. So that's just something to think about. And that's the way you need to look at this. You need to look at your environment. What's the risk of being audited? And then going into this next bullet, probably the one most important thing is you will be comparing your historical costs and trying to estimate paid time off as you go forward. And of course, you'll be looking at legacy controls and limits on that benefit as well. But that one, historical costs versus estimating, that's what we got into, and it's a challenge. Okay, moving right along, cost allocation and allowability. Basically here, what we're starting to do is getting into the client's cost accounting system. That's basically because we need to know basically how they're allocating detailed direct and indirect costs. And the last of a work plan is really getting into the weeds of the client. This is probably really where it's at. We need to understand, how do they deal with salary versus hourly people? Will this benefit, usually this benefit applies to salaried exempt. I have not yet seen it applied at all to hourly personnel. And often sometimes in this particular entity, they were into a manufacturing. So it was only really the indirect personnel that were exempt that this applied to. So it can be very, very specific. And then how do you deal with total time reporting or uncompensated overtime? How will this all impact? So basically what we're trying to do is do an analysis of that. We'll get to that in a minute. The last thing we tried to do, which was probably more pie in the sky, and that was trying to find out what other government contractors are doing. And there are companies and entities out there and larger public accounting firms that will do occasional surveys. Hopefully, maybe some of those people, I know we got someone with APO on us, APO, how to pronounce it, forgive me. They may want to look at, as they do their annual salary reviews and compensation and benefits, try to say, has an entity considered unlimited PTO? We have not been able to find any survey dealing with government contractors. So I'm going to turn it over to Yev again.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, Paul. All right, so question number three of the polling questions. Is any organization represented at this session considering unlimited PTO? And it would have been curious also to ask this question at the beginning and then kind of toward the end where we are now to see if those responses change. But be it as it may, again, yes or no question or unsure. See how people respond. All right. So in this case, yes is taking the minority with 16% of the vote, and no or unsure are pretty tied. Actually, unsure got the majority of the vote with 44%, with no getting 41%.
I am totally amazed that there are five entities that are in the process of considering unlimited PTO. So that, to me, that would be about right. You know, okay, it's 16%. It's a little bit higher than the average of U.S. employers at being about 6%. So obviously, this is something that's out there in the world that's been discussed. And I appreciate your honesty in telling us that this is a serious thing. I've even heard a few people, even in my own firm, saying, yeah, Paul, this is eventually the way of the world. So that is interesting, too. Thank you for your response there. So there's one slide that basically was our analysis, and it's a lot. So basically what we started with was, and we've changed some of the numbers and everything, but basically we did an average determine here's the balance at the beginning of the year. We add the accrued, we subtract the taken, and guess what? We have the final estimate for a particular full year. And as you know, it's pretty hard to predict as you go into future years what it will be. And so a lot of times what we'll do is we'll just leave it at this estimate. We believe, and maybe because we're old fuddy-duddies, that, and because we've seen these surveys, that people will actually use less of the unlimited PTO than they would if they had the accrued benefit. It's just our own thoughts. But basically, in a benevolent, and let me emphasize, a benevolent management would give a lot of time, and that's what these bottom lines, for the change or the transition. So as an example, if we're in FY24 and they're in a calendar year, around the 1st of April, at the end of the first quarter, so we're going to let them know this is your last year for this benefit. Everything will not change for this year. As we go into 2025, we start with unlimited PTO, but we will let you roll over in 2025 and use up during that entire year. And let's just say, pretend there's 160 hours that they have, and they can use, if they can use it, up in 2025. But at the end of 2025, that's it. In the benevolent management, because remember, there's no real standard. Different people are going to do different things. But in the benevolent management world, we would say that even in 2025, if you happen to leave our company, terminated, and you have some balance left, you can take it. So maybe of the 160, you have 65 hours left, you leave, we'll give you that balance. However, after December 31st, before the stroke of midnight, or you can say the policy ends on the 30th and the new policy, or basically no more accrued PTO can be used. But on 12/31/2025, it ends completely. If you haven't used all your PTO, we've given you a year and three quarters to know it and to use it up, to plan for it. You lose whatever remains, and as well as the accrued benefit of PTO if you were to leave. So starting 1/1/26, everybody's on unlimited PTO. It's just you take it, you don't have any more rollover balance, and you can't get anything when you leave. So that's the benevolent. The one thing down here that could be lost is, and this is a CAS requirement, but it would also make sense. I have a funny feeling if DCA or government's watching over your shoulder, is in 2025, you still have this accrued amount that you're eventually going to have to write off. It may be as high as 192,000. It may be less than 102,000, but you'll have to credit that back. If you have a separate fringe pool where it's captured, that's where it would go, or to overhead or G&A or overheads in G&A, however you allocate it. So remember that the unused part. And then as you go forward and you're making projections, the government is going to be concerned that the credits are reflected in future projections. Real quickly, I know we're hitting the final hour here, but just a few takeaways that you may want to think about, and there are four of them. Companies and recipients can transition from this. The only thing they need to be aware of is state laws, and to get with, I would get with a benefit legal representation, lawyers that understand the Department of Labor laws, U.S. Department, and like if you're in Maryland or D.C. or Virginia, where we're located in that region, find out what the state rules are so that you avoid any illegal forfeiture of earned paid absence. I think if you went with my so-called benevolent management plan, you'd be fine. The second thing is from the surveys, just remember the unintended consequences here, trying to give them a benefit, but because these groups are in this teamwork, they're doing integrated work together as a part of a team. Some employees were reluctant to use it, some inability to use it because of a heavy workload, or at the end, because they were all exhausted, they forced them to have paid absence just because they were exhausted. So, you know, you don't really want your employees to get into that world. The third thing, basically, the benefit, unlimited benefit for federally funded award contracts will not mitigate, obviously, the requirement of time tracking. Time tracking requires and facilitates the direct and indirect allocation of costs. It's a mandatory thing. So that will stay if you're a contractor or in a federal assistance award. And finally, notice of the change in benefit will initiate. If you're in the DOD world and you give this to an ACO, the ACO will ask defense contract audit agencies, or they may have their own group that will review this benefit, because the way DCA is, God bless them, but they tend to look, you know, they kind of, they can over scrutinize it. Let's just be aware of it. Even if your costs go down, I used to be that way too when I was a government auditor. There's a lot of suspicion and so forth, and they just kind of, you know, roll their eyes kind of thing. And it's just so new, they're not used to it. And they won't know what to do with it until they finally write a policy on it. But so be prepared that they're going to want to see all your schedules, the changes to the benefit plans, the changes accounting policies, procedure. And I wouldn't even be surprised if you're cast covered, they'll probably say it is a change and a cost accounting practice change. And really all they have to do is insinuate that or suggest that. And you're going to have to prove that it isn't, or you're going to have to do a cost impact statement. So with that, I will turn it back over to Yev, and there's the acknowledgements, and we're so grateful for those resources. Yev?
Yep. Yeah, perfect, Paul. That was a lot of really great information. And actually, one of the questions that came in, I think, is a pretty interesting kind of summary, if you will, of a lot of what you covered. So I'm going to pose the question, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts. And then I actually have some thoughts that made me think as you were presenting all of this. So the first question is, besides offering to Gen Z this as a benefit, this meaning unlimited PTO, is there another reason why an organization might consider transitioning to unlimited PTO?
Yes. And the unfortunate thing is they're doing it for balance sheet purposes, because obviously it's a liability. I mean, compared to all liabilities, current liabilities, it's probably the smallest, but it is a liability that one day as a 1231, when you know, it's going to be eliminated. And so it could help their position in terms of their current ratio or the working capital ratio. And some are doing it for that purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. What I was thinking of when I saw this question was, so everything that you were mentioning earlier, Paul, I think there's kind of an implied mention that there's almost like a cultural shift that would have to happen. And that cultural shift in an organization considering unlimited PTO is almost that you're almost moving toward more of a results-driven organization. With this unlimited PTO, you're giving the employees presumably more autonomy to manage their work. And if you've set all of this up correctly at perhaps the management level, the more strategic level, you have strategic company goals. And as you think through those goals and what are the components that go into meeting those goals, and you trickle down those goals kind of toward the management team and then the staff team, you're with something like moving toward unlimited PTO, again, you're moving toward everything being more results driven. So to me, that's almost kind of a benefit as well for organizations that want to be more results driven. You're given this autonomy, yes. And yes, you're removing liabilities from your balance sheet, But perhaps more importantly, it's a cultural shift.
Definitely.
Okay. And it looks like the second question that came in. So can you remind us again what might increase the audit risk of a government contractor considering all of this?
Yeah, in summary, real quickly, the increased risk would be one, if you have cost type contracts, two, if you have DOD contracts, because DOD has so much more oversight responsibilities, and you have DCA themselves, they're separate audit agents, separate ACO. And last, if you're a prime versus a sub. So if you have cost type, you're in DOD and you're a prime, you're probably seeing a lot of audits and a lot of interface with auditors. And so you really have to be attentive as you integrate this new policy, incorporate.
Excellent. Okay. And actually, as we were going through this, another question popped up. I think we may still have a little bit of time. So how would this unlimited PTO policy be implemented with non-exempt workers?
That is a good question. And I have no answer, I'll be honest with you. I think, again, you would have to do a separate study. It's the only thing I could suggest, because we did it only for indirect exempt people in a very large GovCon, in a very large overall entity. So my suggestion to you is do the same thing, go back to our work plan and look at the specifics of what will happen for your policies versus the government's policies and how you're tracking it, and go through that analysis of what is historically happening for non-exempt and how they take off time, and then start to do some projections based on that analysis. That's the best thing I would say. Just try to follow some of the approach we used in our work plan.
Yeah, and I think that particular question is particularly relevant now, because if I'm not mistaken, some of the rules surrounding exempt versus non-exempt and that classification is starting to change or be considered for change once again. So it is very timely. So, all right, excellent. Well, I don't see any other questions. And so given that, I think we'd like to once again thank everyone for attending today's session. We encourage you all to follow us on social media at GRFCPAs. And visit our website for any upcoming events and alerts. Thank you all once again, and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the GRF on the Go podcast. Visit our website at grfcpa.com for more information about the services we provide, the industries we serve, or to request a quote.